You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the podcast network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. Welcome to episode 25 of the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, June 25th, 2008. I'm Martin Spriggs, and joining me today, as usual, is Sally Draper, my weekly podcasting buddy, Wells Technology trainer, and all-around good egg. Hi, Sally.
Hey, Martin. How's it going today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Good. And we're also pleased to have back with us our semi-regular classroom technology correspondent direct from New London, Wisconsin, Gail Potratz. Hi, Gail.
Good morning.
How are things in New London?
Things are sunny and bright today. It looks like a beautiful summer day.
Beautiful. Today is our 25th show, as I mentioned, and I thought maybe we could take just a couple minutes and talk about essentially why the show exists, at least from my perspective. And it's great to have Gail on because she has kind of a unique perspective on that, since she was just a regular old listener until we coaxed her onto coming on the show and helping us out at least once a month. And at least in my mind, Sally and Gail, one of the reasons that I wanted to start the show and kind of craft the format as it is today is, you know, recognizing that we have a listening audience probably made up of extremely busy call workers and other church workers, whether they be called or otherwise, who don't have a lot of time to kind of wade through this really rapidly moving technology environment that we live in. And I have a heart for technology and a heart for ministry, and recognize that there are some wonderful technology tools that could be used for ministry purposes. And one of the things that I hope we get across in this show is how technology can be used, at least certain tools within the technology space can be used for good ministry purposes. Sally, you know, as you think about the Wells Tech Podcast, what comes to your mind as we try and put the show together each week?
Well, I was just thinking, Martin, that it's an amazing time that we live in. We are really on cutting edge in terms of technology, and we have to be really wise in our use of it. And hopefully what we're doing here on the podcast is pointing people in some direction so that they don't have to spend a lot of time investing in figuring things out or evaluating a lot of different tools, but they can be more focused in their use of the tools that are available, and also practice good stewardship, because there's so much out there that's available for free or very affordable prices now. So, you know, just being wise stewards of the resources that God's given us to spread that precious word.
Yeah, and when you mention stewardship, I immediately think of stewardship of time as well, that certainly you could spend a lot of time trying to figure out, you know, what's the best technology tool for this, or what could I be using for that? How do I do this on our website? You know, should I be thinking about blogging? Those kinds of things. And hopefully this podcast can act, and we can act as a resource for people who have questions about technology topics as they relate to ministry. Gail, how about you? You come from, obviously, that busy call worker perspective, you know, and you started listening to the show. You know, maybe you give us a little bit of a perspective on what you were thinking the show was really good for, and hopefully give us that perspective.
Well, as a listener, that's the reasons you just mentioned were exactly the reasons that I started listening and kept listening, is because, well, I knew the source. I know both of you quite well, and I know that you do good work, and you're doing the legwork for me out there.
Well,
you're doing
the idea.
Legwork for me, right. You know, because all called workers are very busy people, and I really appreciate having somebody out there checking out all this stuff so I don't have to, because I don't have time to do that. Mm-hmm. And so somebody's doing it for me, doing a good job, looking for a inexpensive solution when possible, which is always good.
Right.
And I just love the fact that I could tell you I've listened to this podcast in so many different places and you know, the mobility of it and, you know, listening whenever I want to, whenever I can fit it in, really works great.
Yeah, I listen to a number of podcasts when I'm either exercising or on the road, and it seems like I'm making a better use of my time by filling my ears with different things. And it could be devotional, it could be technological, it could be just reading a book, and I'm just not mindlessly wasting time driving or running or whatever it is. So, you know, I think there's a lot of potential here. So hopefully we are doing that on the Wells Tech Podcast, and we're going to try and do it again today. As we have been trying to do now for the last couple months when Gail has joined us, we're trying to focus on classroom technologies, and we recognize that a lot of our listeners are teachers, or maybe even better, we would call them educators, because we're going to talk about a topic that's maybe not just specific to the classroom, but to educators in general. And that's a continuation of the topic that we began last month when Gail was with us, talking about Web 2.0 in the classroom. And we talked about digital natives and digital immigrants, but we never got to really talk about what this new web, this what we're calling Web 2.0, has to do with how educators are trying to help their students learn. So maybe let's ask the first question. What's the difference between Web 2.0 and, I guess, Web 1.0, which we really never called Web 1.0, just the web. So what's the difference between Web 2.0 and Web 1.0?
Well, I think that the main difference is I've heard it described as the first web was the read web, mm-hmm. and 2.0.
Read only, right?
It read only. Mm-hmm. And the second is write, you know, the read and write web.
Mm-hmm.
It's interactive and allows for self-publishing,
right.
Which before you just read, but you didn't typically respond unless it was by email. And now with blogs and wikis and other tools that we have out there, people are able to publish their own material very easily to the web and get response, comments from other people as well. Collaboration becomes done more easily through these tools. I guess that would be the way I would define the difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and I was kind of just reminded of how we used to do church websites and how the capabilities we have for doing church websites today. And I think that's a really good example of the differences in the read-only versus the read-write web. It used to be that the church website was only a function of one really technical, geeky kind of person in your congregation that could figure FTPs and all kinds of HTML coding and all kinds of things like that. And now we have really professional looking websites, and we're able to manage them online, doing that reading and writing, having multiple people with privileges to update the website and things like that. So I think that's a pretty good illustration of the shift that's occurred from the read only to the read write. It's definitely put given the common person the ability to participate in the web. And that's a huge thing. That's really unprecedented. In the past, only big companies or authors or things like that could publish content. And now everyone can. And that's, you know, obvious with the proliferation of blogs and wikis and things that are out there on the web now, you know, just showing how popular it is and how many people want to have a voice out on the web.
Now, along with that, I think we need to talk about some of the concerns that are raised with this read-write web. With the read-only web, it was essentially one-way communication, and there was some controls, and it wasn't kind of what I would call the Wild Wild West, you know, where everybody can get on and anybody can say anything they want. This free, you know, kind of the free speech movement came to the web, and when that came to ahead in the 60s in our country, that created all kinds of controversy as well. And I think that we're kind of in that stage right now where you've got a free speech movement coming to the web, which means anything is fair game. The good, the bad, and the ugly. And that causes some concerns for, I would think, especially students and educators in general as they're thinking about using, you know, Web 2.0 technologies. We had Peter Schmidt on a couple of weeks ago talking about some of those concerns and how he, I believe he was using Facebook. What are some of the other concerns as we think about using this Web 2.0 concept in our classrooms and certainly within Christian settings?
Well, I think one thing that you have to teach your students and really make them aware of is that what they put on the web is very public, and it doesn't go away. So, you know, if they think something is really cool to say now or whatever, they may not feel the same way, you know, 5, 10, 20 years from now when you can Google their name or whatever the flavor of searching is in the future and come up with all of this history of their life that they've published on the web.
So yeah, web has a long memory. Yeah,
exactly. Just kind of impressing that on our students and helping them to have really strong guidelines to go by and understanding the importance of that that public nature of what they do publish on the web, I think is just foremost as we teach our students about the web.
Mm-hmm. Gail, what thoughts do you have on the concerns that a Web 2.0 experience might raise in a classroom setting?
Well, I think the control and the structure that the teacher provides built into the lessons that use these tools takes care of a lot of that, because when you're preparing these tools, there are often safety nets built within them where you can keep a lot of what you're doing with a classroom private for just the classroom or the school to see. They have ways, you know, that these can be either public pieces for the whole web, or you can privatize them a little bit. And I think it's always good to keep them a little more private when you're starting out, especially before everybody gets used to the process and such. But I think the key is the teacher and the teacher's willingness to structure a good, solid project using the tools.
Right. Right. And there are a lot of those types of tools, and we're not going to go into much detail at this point, but there are many, many ways to collaborate. We've talked about the use of Skype. We mentioned Facebook. There's a tool now that's really, you know, gaining some steam called Twitter, and maybe we should talk more about that on a later show. Flickr is a social photo sharing site. I mentioned last week one of my picks of the week was the Delicious website. So you've got social bookmarking sites, another tool called Furl, just all kinds of things. Maybe we should talk about how those now find their way into classroom usage. I think there's probably lots of avenues, and maybe not just classroom as we think of it in a kind of an elementary school setting, but even maybe confirmation class and those kinds of things. So, Gail, you're probably more on the forefront than certainly I am. Maybe you too, Sally. How do we see these tools kind of manifesting themselves in today's classroom?
Okay. I think that a good place to begin is with just a little bit of a review comment on when we left off last time. We kind of left with the idea that it can be overwhelming for teachers to be introduced to all these tools and to think that they're expected to use them, you know, in the classroom and whatnot, because it was a big thing to get people on board with using the web when it first came out, too, using it correctly in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a continuation of that original movement. But now the thing that eases, that I would like to ease teachers' minds with, is that you have to go at this in steps. We talked last time about supplemental usage, where you just take a little piece of technology and supplement a lesson with that. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to just give you an example of a lesson like that. You could use something. I talked about perhaps you're doing a project of studying, studying in history, and you're talking about one of the wars, for example. There are places out on the internet, listservs, that you can go to and help get your kids connected to somebody that can give them a personal experience about that phase in history that you're talking about. It doesn't have to be a war, but there's a lot of veteran ones out there. So
probably couldn't go back to the Civil War, I assume, with that kind of technology.
No, right. But honestly, even World War II, you know, is getting to the point with that you have to look a little harder to find someone to speak to a classroom
on that issue. That would be really neat to talk firsthand with somebody who lived the experience that, you know, certainly was never possible, or you just read about it in a newspaper or an encyclopedia entry, right?
Right. So that would just be merely, you know, making use of a listserv and getting out there and making that connection and doing a little emailing. And that's only part, that's a little piece of maybe your whole project. Your whole project is bigger than that, but you're just going to add that little piece of technology this time. To me, that would be a good example of a supplemental use of technology. And then after you get comfortable with that, you can move on to doing more project-based learning. So I'd like to talk just a little bit about project-based learning. That's a kind of for a long time now, it's not new by any means. Students have been doing projects in school. I mean, we did them way back when we were in school. It's a long-standing method that teachers have used and have realized that when kids are creating something of their own that's built on knowledge that they've gathered, they get excited about learning like that. So today, problem-based learning, or sometimes called inquiry-based learning, I'm kind of using them interchangeably, is really popular for several reasons. And I think that when you look at our culture today and the workforce and the culture, the 21st century skills point to the fact that today project management systems have found a place in the industry now, and people who work in industry are working in this same type of problematic type culture where they're collaborating and solving things. And that we need to be teaching kids to learn that way, because that's the way they're going to be working when they get out in the world later on.
So, Gail, is the concept a teacher throws out a problem, and maybe they're not even really defining it in a great detail, so it's not a, you know, a yes or no or a multiple choice kind of a question, but it's a little bit broader problem set that now the educator is going to allow them to use some of these tools to research and find a solution for? Is that really what you mean when you say, you know, a problem set and project-based learning?
Right. In its purity, the actual the concept is that the student helps create the initial question.
Really? Okay.
You know? Because, you know, it can be teacher-led, of course, but as the more the student has involvement in the creation of the essential question for discovery, the more involved they're going to be in the lesson. But that's not something you're going to learn how to do overnight. So, but yes, that's the top of the ladder, I would say. And people often think that doing things on the internet or whatever, those lessons are less structured because kids are just out there flying around on the internet.
Right.
And that is absolutely not true. These types of lessons that are created using web tools and the internet the successful ones are very structured. They're structured for success so that kids know exactly the process. There's more teaching to the process of learning than we usually do in traditional education.
Is that where like web quests and those kinds of things come in?
Right. Web quests are a great place to start. For a person who's not done much of this, web quests can be inquiry-based or project-based. They don't have to be. There are many, many different kinds of web quests out there. But yes, that's the general genre that they fit into. And the thing about web quests and why they're a good place to start is there are hundreds and thousands of the quality ones already out there for you. So again, this is a small step. Now you've used some tools, supplementary, and now you're going to get into actually doing a web project-based learning activity. You don't quite feel confident enough to build one from scratch, so you go out on the web and you search. Very easy to search for WebQuest. If you put WebQuest in Google, you do not want to do it that way because mm-hmm. you'll have way too many to go through.
Right.
There are many, many indexed sites, but the one I'm going to talk to you about today was built by actually Bernie Dodge, who is the creator of the WebQuest. These were created back in 1997 about.
Mm-hmm.
And he has built a tool called Quest Garden. It's located at www.questgarden.com. And this site, there's an index there of WebQuests that people have built at this site. And on this site, there is a tool where you can actually build your own WebQuest. So once you go into the index and you find a good a quest you might want to use, I listed a few of them there that you might want to go and check out. There are some in the show notes. Sally will have them down there for you. I just picked one on the Civil War, and that was done by a student of mine, a college student of mine. And the other one was done by myself for a middle school classroom. The Civil War one is also kind of middle upper uh-huh. Elementary level. But these are just two I picked for people if they would like to look at them a little closer and see. This is an easy way for you to match your goals and purposes for your unit with something that's already been developed. And then your kids go to the web and they work through this. It's very, very structured. Every WebQuest has the same six steps that the creator goes through when it's created.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead, Mark.
So I'm sorry, Gil. That's great. I think that these kinds of tools at least give you an idea of what the possibilities are. I think teachers probably who aren't, we talked last time about how teachers are typically digital immigrants, not digital natives. So they're really not sure, the depth and the breadth of the internet and how to feel comfortable in it. So
right.
These kinds of tools, explore maybe different corners and crevices that you weren't aware of or different uses for it, especially when you're talking about Web 2.0. So it's not just as
right.
a reference library or Wikipedia kind of a concept, but there are other interactive tools that
right.
can be brought together to increase this educational experience. So this might be a great start for a teacher who really just doesn't know where to start. So they figure out, hey, let me take a look at what somebody else has done.
Right, and Bernie Dodge is at San Diego State University. So if you Google WebQuest, the first thing that will come up will be his site, which also has, it's a different site than this, but it's also has an index and a lot of really good project-based learning information to connect to.
Mm-hmm.
I should have added that into the show notes. Maybe
Great.
I can still do that.
Great.
On this site too, what makes that WebQuest, I wouldn't say, they've been around since the Reed web, okay, presenting
right.
that on, that's just Reed, but what makes this site a Web 2.0 tool is the fact that in this Quest Garden, there is a place where you can create your WebQuest, like I said, and that's very interactive. You're creating it on the web, on the fly, with directions given to you, and there's even collaboration available because other teachers
right.
that are working within this, it's a little community.
Mm-hmm.
So this was what makes it 2.0, I guess. And I do have to tell people, though, that it is not free, totally free. You can use it. There's a trial for 30 days. It will cost you $20 for 2 years,
okay.
which to me is very minimal. Very minimal. So it's worth checking out, definitely.
Okay.
So, that would be a safe place to start learning how to do some creating of lessons.
Yeah, absolutely. I think next time we have you on, Gail, we can probably take step two of this process of project-based learning and begin to talk about striking out on your own and some of the tools like blogs and wikis and podcasts that you can kind of weave together to kind of do the same thing, but more
right.
pioneer some of these concepts. And I think you've got some great examples
sure.
there too that we can share, which we don't have time to share today. So that's a great start as we're thinking about how to leverage this Web 2.0 thing and bring that into the classroom. Thanks for sharing that, Gail. That's great. We're going to stay in the educational realm with our interview A couple weeks ago, we had a chance to spend some time with Jim Brandt, who's our administrator, Wells administrator for parish schools, and Jeff Spicer, dean of academics at Illinois Lutheran Schools, who are leading the charge within the Wells circles for a student information system called PowerSchool. It's a student information system that allows schools effectively to manage student report cards, hot lunch, all kinds of different things, as you'll hear in the interview. And then once we're done listening with the interview, we'll get Gail's feedback, because Gail is a user of PowerSchool there at Emmanuel in New London. So let's listen to our interview with Jim Brandt and Jeff Spicer on PowerSchool. Joining us today is Jeff Spicer, Dean of Academics at Illinois Lutheran Schools in Crete, Illinois, and Jim Brandt, Wells Administrator for Parish Schools right here in beautiful Milwaukee. Welcome, Jeff and Jim.
Thanks, Martin.
We have a number of things that we'd like to talk to you about, but primarily we want to focus on a kind of a new technology field for a lot of our schools, and that's the use of student information or student management systems. And the one that the Synod is offering and we've negotiated a deal with Pearson on is PowerSchool. Jeff or Jim, can you tell us exactly what PowerSchool is? I'm sure some in our listening audience have no idea what we're talking about.
Well, Martin, PowerSchool is, as you said, a student information system. That means it includes a database, which is student-centered. There's a web-based gradebook for teachers that interfaces with that database. There's also a web portal for parents and students where they can access and view the students' achievement information over the web.
Let's take this a step higher and just talk about school management systems in general. What would be the benefit of using that over the traditional methods, you know, the paper methods or just the, you know, maybe the Microsoft Office products that are used through the school systems now by a lot of them? And, you know, maybe why would a school want to jump into a kind of a full-fledged system like this?
Well, I would say that the real benefit of it is you've got a central database for your students that's tracking all of their data. And in addition to just the demographic information, we've also got with it grade management for teachers, attendance management, and then you can get some advantages out of there that, especially with PowerSchool, where you can have a very, very rapid turnaround for report cards. And then also with PowerSchool, you have a real advantage of, with that information, being able to customize it and make it do to fit the situation that we have for our Wells schools.
So is this all online, or is there something that each teacher needs, you know, on their laptop or desktop, or the school needs a server for? How does that work technically?
From the technical point of view, it's all web-based. Our server lives in Milwaukee, and our 33 different schools are spread over 10 states around the country. Mm-hmm. What's really required is a fast internet connection in order to run the gradebook, which, like Jim said, is web-based, and all the other access is log in on a secure password, mm-hmm, and use the product.
So how quick is quick? Does it need to, I assume, something above dial-up, but DSL would be all right, or cable, or something that maybe a teacher would already have in their home if they're, you know, if they have that kind of connection?
Right, yep, DSL or cable. We're using simple cable that's provided by our local cable company here for free, mm-hmm, and that's running it for the entire school building.
So teachers can basically go home and do grades and log into the system. They don't have to be at school to use it?
That's correct.
Yeah, I think that's one of the real advantages, the ability to enter grades from virtually anywhere that you have an internet connection. And these days, that's getting to be just about anywhere you go.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that that's connected directly to the database, and as the teacher's going about doing their everyday work of correcting and entering grades, they're building the school's student database at the same time.
So it's really kind of the nerve center of the school in many ways, correct?
Yeah, well, I think you could say that.
The digital nerve center, at least, sure.
Another advantage, I think, that PowerSchool presents, at least the way we have it configured, is all of our schools are, especially the smaller schools, challenged to maintain technology and maintain servers and all of the work that's involved in the care and feeding and backup and so forth. And with a central server at a data center here in Milwaukee, that takes that cost and that responsibility off the school's shoulders.
Right.
So, Jim, you kind of addressed one of my questions. Is this geared toward a particular size of school? Is it more advantageous for larger schools, or you mentioned smaller schools even taking advantage of it?
Well, we've got schools that run the gamut from 200-plus students to schools that have 20 or 30 students involved in the program right now. And I believe it's serving their various needs quite well. The product itself is designed for school districts up to 10,000 students. So it is very customizable and scalable.
Was that one of the reasons that you selected PowerSchool over the competition? What guide us through maybe the selection process, Jim?
Sure, Martin. We reviewed a number of different products as we were looking at this issue several years ago, including a product that is known by some of our schools, Skyward, another product, Infinite Campus. And there just are numerous other products out there. Some of the schools that are working with us previously used Hunter System, and I had some experience with that program myself. And, you know, we reviewed a number of those programs, and things that I guess helped raise PowerSchool to the top in our minds were the intuitive interface of PowerSchool, especially in the parent portal. The fact that it's an all-in-one product, it is different from, let's say, a Skyward product, which has multiple modules and a cost for each module. It was simple for us. PowerSchool is one program, and one price gives you everything that it offers. The pricing structure fit our budget, and I guess we really appreciated the strong positive relationship that we quickly built with the representatives of PowerSchool. It's not a perfect system, but I believe it's serving our schools well, and each year with more experience, I believe the experience is really getting better for the schools. Maybe Jeff can comment on that.
We're in our third year of using the product, and it's really come very quickly for us. Our technical guru, I guess, that we depend on for the, you know, the hardware side of it and making sure everything keeps itself going is Eric Paulson. He's working out of Wisconsin, and working with him would be Dave Schrader from Wisconsin and myself. And as far as making it more and more streamlined and easier to operate, as we became more proficient at using it, we have found out that in a lot of cases, our schools do things in such a similar way that rolling out the product for elementary schools is relatively easy, just because of the fact that since all of us went to the same college, we tend to do things in a very similar manner. We were kind of all taught the same way how to do things, and what we thought was very complex at first turned out to be easier than our initial concerns.
So the three of you then handle all of the conversions if a school is interested in joining, they're going to work with the one of the three of you to kind of convert their data, if they have data, get the system tweaked to the way they want it, do the training, that kind of thing?
That's correct.
How long a process is that? Is that pretty onerous?
As far as making the transition, it would depend on where a school is right now. We can pull the data out and kind of massage it a little bit in perhaps Excel and then import it into PowerSchool, and that's a fairly painless process that goes really quickly. And then there would also have to be some training so that your site administrator does understand how the system works and anybody who does need it, because we're looking at three different interfaces for the PowerSchool product. One of them is the admin side, which would be secretaries and principals primarily, or in my position as a guidance counselor as well, I use that one very, very much. The teacher portal is a completely different look, which gives them their attendance abilities and their student information and also the gradebook access. And then the family portal, which is the, shouldn't really say family, but the parent and student portal, gives the feedback for the parents with the grades. And also a real popular feature at our school is the daily bulletin, which keeps people up to date, and it's what's going on today at school. And so that's in there as well. In addition to, you know, we can schedule our classes for next year online and things like that as well. So that part of it is really coming along and developing all the time. Mm-hmm. But each school has to have someone who understands how they're being used. And so there'll be some training for an admin user, site admin we call them for our purposes in Wells, and then also that site admin goes back and trains his teachers how to use the product as far as the teacher portal is concerned, and then also trains the parents how to use it.
What I think I'm hearing you say, Jeff, is that there is a community of Wells schools that are using it and obviously share information between the different schools and support each other in the process. So even though there's a site admin at each school, they're really not on their own. They have a whole group of Wells schools to fall back on. Is that correct?
Very true.
That's right, Sally. We've got a listserv that's developed with all of the site administrators on it, and they fire out questions to one another quite regularly and support each other and assist each other. And that's really our first level of technical support as well. Jeff, Eric, and Dave answer those technical support questions normally very quickly. And actually, I think this year, Jeff, it's been rare that we've even had to go to PowerSchool themselves for additional support.
Very true.
So what is the cost, and how does somebody get started if a school's interested? Well, let's even take a step back. If somebody's interested, how would they reach out and find out a little bit more? Is there a demo site, or is there a process through which they can learn a little bit more? And then, you know, if they are interested, what does it take to get going as far as cost?
Sure. There are a couple different avenues for an online demo. One would be to go directly to the PowerSchool website itself and to get a demo from the folks at PowerSchool. A more tailored demo would be to contact Jeff Spicer. And Jeff, I believe you do some demos with folks, right?
We can, yep.
And so that can help a school learn more about it. Jeff has also done some presentations at teacher conferences, and that's a good place for people to learn more about PowerSchool as well. Mm-hmm. We've got some very limited information on our website, which typically points back to the main PowerSchool website. As far as getting started goes, we have a list of schools that are coming on board next year, meaning the 2008-2009 school year. We still have some space for additional schools to come on board with us, and they simply need to contact the Wells Commission on Parish Schools office, contact Rachel DiGiorgio, our administrative assistant. You can call her at 414-256-3222, and she'll send you a commitment form, and it's just a matter of sending that form back to Rachel.
So is it a per-student cost, or how does the pricing structure work?
It is a per-student cost, Martin. Pricing breaks down this way. During the first year, schools are charged $16 per student. That fee includes the assignment of one of our three certified PowerSchool implementation men, either Jeff, Eric, or Dave, to work directly with the school and help them import their data and get set up and ready for the school year. On an ongoing basis, after that first year, the cost is $12 per student per year, and we automatically renew the schools unless they contact us and let us know that for some reason they need to drop out of the program. Training is an additional cost. And the initial product training is a four-day workshop. We hold it at the Wells office in Milwaukee. And this year that training will take place July 7th through the 10th. And the cost is $400 per person. And travel and lodging expenses are the school's responsibility.
So where's the program going, Jim? You said you had 33 people, 33 schools currently using the product, and some more lined up for this summer. Is the goal to try and get all of our schools on the system? So data integration and, you know, some of the features that can be spread across the schools is of benefit to the whole system, or where do you see it going?
Well, we would love to enroll all of our schools and get them on board. Obviously, that's something that can happen over time, and there certainly would be some blessings realized in such a scenario. With a single server configuration or an array of servers as we grow the program in the future, if a student transfers, let's say, from St. John's Lutheran School in Lannan, Wisconsin, to St. Mark's Lutheran in Citrus Heights, California, it's a matter of some keystrokes to transfer that student from one school to another and have all of their historical data and demographic information go with them. Huh. Or one might envision an area Lutheran high school with all of its feeder schools using the program and hundreds of hours of data entry over the summer for incoming freshmen can be alleviated as that data is transferred electronically from one school to another in PowerSchool. So there's some, you know, great opportunities that really are built into a system like this. Mm-hmm. Currently, as Jeff said, we've got 33 schools in the program, and we're serving about 4,300 students through PowerSchool. With 10 to 12 more schools coming on board next year, and we can take as many as 15, we believe we're going to be between 5,500 and 6,000 students next year. And that's roughly one-fifth of our preschool through eighth grade student population.
Okay. Very good. Sally, any other questions from you?
No, I think that kind of wraps it up. Gives me a good picture of what PowerSchool is all about.
Neat. Well, thank you for joining us, Jim and Jeff. Certainly blessings on your continued work in his service, and we'll be following the progress of PowerSchool closely. It sounds like something that could really benefit schools, especially those schools that don't have any kind of system and they're doing all this manually. I can't imagine not getting excited about a system that brings all that together. So, Jim, Jeff, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Sally.
Our pleasure. again, our thanks to Jim and to Jeff for spending time, and thanks for their efforts in leading this Power School initiative. We've got a number of schools taking advantage of this, one of which is Emmanuel in New London, which is where you serve, Gail. What's been your experience with Power School?
Oh, Power School has been wonderful here at our school. We have been in it now for, I think it's the third year. We've been.
Oh,
in
really?
It
okay, you were one of the first ones then.
Yeah, since the pilot started.
Okay.
So every year has gotten better. Everybody's gotten more comfortable. We made a major change in the program made a change in its format, the way it looks. It's interface this year, and I thought, oh, boy, we're going to have to go through this all again.
Yeah.
That was wrong. The people just, it was so easy, I couldn't believe it.
Good.
So I was real happy about that. When I look at Power School, what I think of, you know, what you read and you hear in the educational world is all about collaborative communities of learners.
Mm-hmm.
You hear that all the time. And really, when you use Power School, it's like being in one of those communities, because through the listserv, the Power School listserv, there's constant communication between all of us who use it.
Right.
So, and that's a neat thing, that other people are using it, you're sharing ideas, you're solving problems. And if you want to talk about good tech support, which, you know, if you're in my position, that's important. If you have a product, you want to know you have good tech support behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Those gentlemen that Jeff and the guys that do this for us, that lead the pack,
mm-hmm.
they are wonderful.
Right.
They are there in, you know, almost immediate if you ever need any help. And they, I mean, sometimes I tend to feel like, oh, this is such a dumb question, I should know this, you know, I feel a little bit shy about, and they never make you feel like you've asked a stupid question. They're
right.
Very good about all questions are worthy questions.
Good.
And I'm sure they hear them all and more than one time. So that is great. The program itself is good because it does its job. It's very stable. We have not had many technology issues with it at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's very stable. It does the grading. It puts the grading and the attendance and comments on assignments out on the internet for parents to see. So it's a good communication tool, very good for a school's communication to the parents. There's other features built in that do that as well, the daily bulletin. There are just a lot of very valuable features, and what makes it particularly good now is it never stays the same. It is just growing. These guys are making it more and more applicable to us as Synod workers, because now we're getting our Terra Nova testing results that
right.
we can put in through there, and they're working very hard to make the reporting system meet our particular needs, because our schools have different needs than the public schools, which Power Schools, you know, serves a great deal of them. So they're not really interested in developing tools for us, but our people are doing that for us,
yep.
which I think is a wonderful thing.
That's one of the advantages I think we have as a Synod, where we have people willing to craft something for our specific needs, and
yep.
then we're sharing that. So that's really the idea behind these relationships, is getting a system that's going to work for a majority of our schools. So if you are interested, obviously, in Power School or learning more, I would suggest contacting Jim Brandt in the Synod offices here, and he can share with you information about how to learn more or even get started. So thanks again to Jim and Jeff. Our tips of the week up next. Gail, you want to lead us off today with your pick of the week?
Sure. My pick is a Web 2.0 tool called...
Imagine that.
Yeah, VoiceThread.
Okay.
And many of you are probably familiar with threaded discussions. They've been around for a long time. This is basically a threaded discussion, but it's a multimedia version.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... So you can put in movies, you can put in pictures, sound, and it has applicable uses to the classroom, and that's why I like it. And there is a sample of a piece that has been done by the school in Peace, Hartford, using this tool. I plan to use it in language arts with 8th grade this year to build some things, and I'm just in the planning phase with it, so I can't really share anything that I've done. But this little sample that you're going to see here is really quite good from some students, which I believe are fourth graders, and I was impressed with how they put the tool use of the tool together in the classroom.
Yeah, what I liked about it, it's very easy to use, and for non-technologically savvy teachers, it's really easy to pick up, and the students pick it up right away, and it's just a good way to interact with, again, Web 2.0 technology. So that's is that voicethread.com? I believe it is.
It is. We'll have a link in the show notes.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Gail. Sally, what's your pick?
I was going to point people to Gizmo's Support Alert Newsletter. I actually got an email this week from Pastor Tim Wagner pointing me to this resource, and it's one that I had subscribed to already and one that I find very useful. I just don't think they come out often enough. I think it only comes out once a month. But it is just a kind of a low-tech newsletter. There's not a whole lot of bells and whistles to their presentation or anything, but what you get once a month is just a lengthy list of useful links, and it covers a variety of different websites and utilities and things like that. There's tech resources, there's links to freeware and shareware utilities, security information, different patches and things that are being released, and then just kind of a potpourri section called Other Useful Stuff, where you just never quite know what you're going to find. There is a free version of the newsletter and a premium version, which only costs $10 a year. And on the premium version, you just get extra links, things they tease you with in the free version you can't see unless you pay for the premium version. You can subscribe to have it delivered to you via email or RSS. And this month's just came out recently. I'll make sure and include a link to it in the show notes. But one thing I found really interesting was the editorial in this month's newsletter is all about the security settings and protection that the particular newsletter author has on his own PCs and things. So it's neat to read about how he uses antivirus and firewalls and things like that on his own systems. Not anything real complicated, but nice to kind of hear it from an expert to see what he's doing. So I find it very worth my skimming of the newsletter, and always find a few links that I am quite impressed with each month. It's Gizmo's Support Alert Newsletter, and we'll have a link in the show notes.
Thanks, Sally. My pick is kind of a fun one. It's a website and a browser extension, both for Firefox and for Internet Explorer, called StumbleUpon. And I literally stumbled upon this probably 6 months ago. It's a site that allows you to feed it your interests. So if you are interested in photography or golf or running or sewing or whatever it is, you know, it could be technological, etc. So you fill out a survey, essentially. You tell StumbleUpon what you're interested in. You install the extension in your Firefox or Internet Explorer browser. And essentially, you get a button on your browser. And when you have some free time, essentially, you hit the button. And it takes you to a random site that matches your interests. I find it particularly useful for this show because I'll plug in different things that are related to maybe things that would come up on the show, and occasionally I hit that button and I'll go to a site that I never knew existed, or and up pops a topic or a website or a concept or an idea or a program that might have ministry application. But I guess I see this more as a more of a pastime, but I know others have used it in other ways too. So StumbleUpon allows you to just surf the web in a smarter way. So rather than just doing searching, they're feeding you sites that they've found. There's a rating system so that those sites that are highly rated by other StumbleUpon users come up first, and you'll come across them, or they'll be presented to you sooner than, you know, maybe some of the ones that are lower rated. There's a whole social networking kind of thing so that you can see what other users are stumbling upon and what they're rating. And you can give a good rating or a poor rating. So if you come across a site that says, hey, this is junk, don't suggest this to anybody, you can do that as well. So StumbleUpon, I think it's StumbleUpon.com.
So, Martin, true confessions here. How much time do you spend on StumbleUpon?
That depends. Not a lot lately, actually. But it's a tempting button to press every once in a while. You know, do it over lunch or, you know, when you've got a couple of minutes in the evening, something like that. So it's kind of fun. Try it out. And it's free, of course. Have you tried it?
I did. I tried it, and I used K through 12 as one of my interests and came up with some fabulous teaching resources.
Yeah, I was very impressed with some of the results. Yeah, I plugged in a few things and you know, sites that I didn't know existed, so give it a shot. Our Wells.net feature of the week, Sally, what do we have this week?
This week I wanted to feature the bulletin board on the Wells.net website. You can get to it at wells.net/jump/bulletin board, and there you're going to find posted available items that congregations are willing to give away, a lot of times for the price of shipping, items that are needed, names that are wanted for different areas of the country where they're doing canvassing, even real estate for sale. Sometimes people donate parcels of land or property to the synod as part of their estate planning, and you'll find items for sale there in real estate. There's also job opportunities and volunteer opportunities posted across the synod, and links to different Wells thrift shops that are open across the synod as well. And if you want to post something on the bulletin board, there's links to the communication services email so that you can contact them and give them your information for the Wells bulletin board. A great resource for all Wells members at wells.net/jump/bulletin board.
And speaking of bulletin boards, that's probably a good place, along with the calendar that I think we've mentioned in the past, to find out what's going on within the Synod at any given time. And one of those is coming up later in July, the MLC Alumni Weekend. Right, Sally?
That's right. I did find this one on the Wells calendar. It's coming up at the end of July, July 25th through 27th at MLC. They're going to be celebrating the classes invite communions from 2003, 1998, and all previous classes ended in a 3 or an 8 from MLC, DMLC, and Northwestern College. So if you're in one of those classes, this is your chance to come and celebrate with your classmates for a fun weekend at MLC. They have all kinds of activities planned, free childcare activities and worship activities, alumni choir, just lots and lots of fun. Steve Balza at MLC is heading up the efforts, and you can go to the website. I'll include a link in the show notes. It's mlc-wells.edu/home/alumni and find out all the details about the weekend, and I'll also include a link to the online registration form. And one reason we wanted to mention it in today's show is that the registration deadline is approaching quickly. It's July 7th, so if you're interested in attending the MLC Alumni Weekend, now's the time to hop online and get registered for it.
Great, thanks. Community feedback is next. Who's talking to us this week, Sally?
Well, I had a couple of things from the Wells Tech listserv that I wanted to mention. Last week, I made reference to the fact that there was a discussion thread going on about calendar software. Particularly, I had actually asked the question out on the listserv because our congregation here in Sleepy Eye was looking for a good printable calendar for our church newsletter and that kind of thing. What I found was really interesting. First of all, Wells Tech listserv subscribers are the best because I instantly got,
Oh, it was incredible. Yeah,
maybe 15 or 20 responses within an hour or something. It was just awesome, and just some excellent links to different resources that are available. But what I thought was really interesting about the whole discussion was I actually asked for information about a print solution, and what I got back was a lot of information about Web 2.0 tools. So
that's what's on people's minds, right?
Yeah, just in our little listserv, you can see that shift that we were talking away from you know, the print to this read-write web that we're all so dependent on now. And so obviously we still need a print calendar to include in our newsletter. And I did find some good leads for different ways of accomplishing that. And so it was really, really helpful. And I think just kind of points to the fact that we have an awesome listserv, and it's great to be part of that community. I consider it a real privilege to be able to tap into all these great brains around the Synod and find out about what's going on. And their congregations and schools. Mm-hmm. And along those same lines, there was a separate listserv discussion that was started asking for some directions on Lutheran elementary school acceptable computer usage policies. And I think this is something all of our schools probably deal with, you know, how to have the proper guidelines, rules, and accountability in place as the students begin to use the computers in the schools, particularly with the vast amount of information, good and bad, that's available on the internet and all the different usages there. So there was some good sharing of information with computer usage policies, including a link to a government website that had a sample computer usage policies for schools. So if you aren't part of the listserv, I encourage you to be part of it, because you're missing out on some great resources and things that are being shared there.
And you can join that listserv right on the Wells Tech Podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. And that's just one of the ways that you can communicate with us, because we monitor that regularly. You can send us an email at wellstech@wells.net. You can leave a comment on the Wells Tech website, or if you are so inclined, leave us a voicemail, 414-375-2334. Love to hear from you. Well, that is going to about do it for the show this week. We're coming up on an hour. Our apologies to our listeners, but hopefully you stuck with us. Great stuff that we shared. And Gail, thanks again for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
Let's close the show with the beautiful piano music of Dawn Galhar. We are going to listen to her play her song All Through the Night from her album Inspirations. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.